Welcome to the supporting cast. This is Eli Goldsmith. Today's guest is actor, producer, and director Elizabeth Banks. In this episode, Elizabeth speaks about growing up in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, as the eldest of four siblings, falling into acting quite literally after suffering a softball injury, and then leaning into theater due to the encouragement of high school teachers. Then came the University of Pennsylvania, where she met her husband and now producing partner, followed by the American Conservatory Theater in San Francisco. This launched Elizabeth's career in entertainment, acting in various successful comedies and dramas throughout the 2000s and 2010s, before stepping behind the camera to produce and direct films ranging from the Pitch Perfect series to last year's Cocaine Bear. Elizabeth Banks on the state of entertainment, the impact of storytelling, and who she regards as the funniest people with whom she shared the screen. This is the supporting cast. Elizabeth Banks.
Hi.
Welcome to the supporting cast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being here. And I should mention, we were talking about this a moment ago, that many of the episodes we do for the supporting cast are virtual. Mm-hmm. We use this technology similar to Zoom where we can see each other, but it's actually we're not in the same place. This is not one of those occasions.
No, I showed up. I'm here in person.
You're here in person.
In the Harvard Westlake Middle School booth, recording sound booth.
That's right.
That's pretty cool.
It is pretty cool.
Yeah. Is this built by students?
I don't think so. I think it was built by a team of professionals, but I'm sure knowing Harvard Westlake students, I'm sure
they easily could have.
I'm sure they could have.
They could have built it.
Yes. They probably created all of the architectural plans.
That's right. Let's hope so.
Just a contractor that came in and did the work. Mm-hmm. But thanks for doing this in person. I appreciate it.
Yeah. It's exciting.
So we always start each conversation grounding ourselves in the present. How are you? How are you doing today?
Wow.
In early spring 2024,
how are you? I like this meditation on being in the now.
Yeah, exactly.
Today is a good day. Why not? I tend to have an optimistic view on most days.
Good.
I'm doing well today. It's a beautiful day outside. The weather has turned, hopefully. I also got to glimpse all the kids, you know, out in the quad here at the middle school, and that's always fun as a parent to get to spy even for a few minutes on what all is happening here, and brings me a little sense of joy to see how excited everyone is to be here and be learning. I love that's just been great.
Good. And you've been happy so far as a Harvard Westlake parent?
So far, my child Felix is my seventh grader, and he seems to be thriving. It's very exciting.
Great.
Yeah. How are you?
I'm doing okay. Yeah, I'm excited to get this season of this podcast. We were just talking about it started. And there's so many interesting people within the Harvard Westlake community.
Yes.
And I'm just so fortunate to be able to talk to many of them. And so getting this season off the ground. I have another job that is a full-time job, but I love doing this. And people seem to be listening and enjoying it. And so I'm excited to bring them more interesting conversations.
Yeah, I hope the Harvard Westlake community enjoys this conversation.
Me too. So we're just coming out of a strike, right? Mm-hmm. You are not only an actor, you're a director, you're a producer. And for the last few months of 2023, mm-hmm. things were sort of halted in the entertainment industry. I guess before talking about now, what was it like during those few months? Was it enjoyable to get some time off? Were you still trying to get some projects sort of quietly started or going?
What was it like? I want to acknowledge how difficult actually the time period was for most people in the industry.
Yeah.
I think it was a time of great solidarity, which is wonderful in its own sense. And I felt that on the picket lines and in the community. I felt that sense of solidarity. At the same time, I think it was really hard on a lot of families, on a lot of companies, a lot of people lost their jobs. I think that the return to work has been a lot slower than people anticipated as well. You know, and I think that that's also a reflection of the larger changes in our industry, not just about strike or about the workers, but really about what is Hollywood right now? How are we keeping up with technology? What is AI going to do? I mean, I just think there are a lot of existential crises happening in this moment in time. And as an artist, you know, I take solace in knowing that the art is still meaningful to people. Creating things about people for people is entertaining people, making people laugh. That has a lot of value still. So I am hopeful and excited and optimistic about the future. But I do think the strike and this moment in particular are still, everybody's still a little bit on shaky ground.
Yeah. You said that art is still meaningful to people. Is there something, I mean, we're going to go back into your background and your upbringing, but kind of, is there something that has really impacted you recently that you've liked?
My favorite movie of the year was actually American Fiction by Cora Jefferson, starring Jeffrey Wright and Sterling K. Brown, Issa Rae, and Tracee Ellis Ross, who I thought was like the best she's maybe ever been. I love her generally, but she was made such an impression in such a short amount of time in American Fiction. I loved that movie. I loved what it had to say about narratives and about ownership over stories and who has the right to tell stories and who doesn't and sort of what that means in our society. And I just thought it was tackling a really interesting question with some really wry tone.
Satire
that I love. And I just thought that the ending was, multiple endings, was perfect. I just thought they brought it all together in a really clever way. I just love the cleverness of the whole endeavor. So I was entertained. It made me think. And I think that's what I typically aim to do. I think it's what most artists aim to do. We want to entertain, but we also want to create some conversation with the audience, with the work. And sometimes. And I thought that was a great work of art.
And let's go to the concerns. You're coming out of this strike, and you say there are some existential crises that the entertainment world is facing. You mentioned AI, obviously the move to streaming, and that was what a lot of the strike was about, and making sure that actors and writers were being compensated fairly for their work. What's the biggest worry, I suppose, that you have trying to get projects off the ground? You're a producer, you have a production company.
Yeah.
Directing movies. What are your biggest concerns?
My biggest concerns as a creator are really about distribution and how do we get things into people's hands? I think that we're living in a more and more fractured world. The algorithm is making sure of that. And so, you know, what I'm being served up is not the same as what my kids are being served up. It's not the same as what you're being served up, right? So we're sort of, I think we're becoming more and more fractured, which means that the culture generally is more fractured. And I'm not sure that that's the best thing for us. You know, I think when there are these cultural moments that we can all participate in, whether it's the Super Bowl or the Eras Tour or a Beyonce song.
When you said the monoculture, I immediately thought Taylor Swift and the Super Bowl.
That's right. We used to have that all the time. We used to have those touchstones once or twice a week. You would have those moments. And I do think there are things that go viral and make the whole culture pay attention, and that's still happening. But I also think that there's a real divisiveness at play, and it's harder and harder as somebody who takes the responsibility of creating art and culture seriously. I think that's what Hollywood has done for 100 years, is really participate in not just telling stories, but we help create culture. You know, we really help influence, you know, what's going on in the larger scheme of things. And as the world becomes more fractured and as people's attention spans get shorter, I think that Hollywood in general is really taking a step back and wondering, well, how do we then influence culture in the same way? Maybe we don't. Maybe we won't have that influence. I don't know. Maybe that's a good thing. I'm not seeing the positive aspects of that right now. I'm definitely feeling like it would be better if there were more things that were bringing us all together than keeping us apart. I'm someone who sort of believes in that sense of community being built around things and around cultural touchstones. And so that's what I'm worried about. That's my biggest concern. My biggest concern is, how do you continue to create community around ideas and put forth things that are artful and connecting for people and to connect audiences to each other and to the work. And so, yeah, I'm sort of in an existential crisis too, maybe.
Well, and that there's a financial model that supports that, you know, because if everyone is an algorithmic unit, you know, and everything is niche, you
yes.
know. I suppose a positive is that you go on the internet and maybe there's something for everybody if you look in the corners of our culture. But as you point out, there are fewer things that everyone is actually paying attention to. Now, let me pause and say, is something like Barbie or Oppenheimer, which actually is contrary to what we're talking about, that actually...
Ish.
And why would you say ish?
Well, one is a biopic of one of the most famous people of all time. We've been making those forever. I mean, there's biopics about every famous man ever. And Barbie was based on ginormous IP, the best-selling doll of all time. So I think IP-driven work is not going anywhere. And biopics are you know, very big. Right? I mean, both Maestro and Oppenheimer, both up for Best Picture, both about, you know, very interesting, very famous people. And so I don't think the biopic is going anywhere anytime soon. And I don't think that IP-driven material is going anywhere anytime soon. That being said, what I think you're getting at was how artfully and exciting they were made and how much money they were given to tell their stories and then how much money they both generated. That's really exciting. I was excited about all of that. You know, I think that anytime two very diverse things can make, that can bring audiences to the theater and in droves like that, it's really exciting for Hollywood as a whole. Mm-hmm. It bodes well, right?
Yeah. And I suppose the other point is neither were sequels,
even though
the point about IP is taken. But I think for the last few years, some of the top grossing movies were all Marvel 7 or whatever it was. And that's fine. But I suppose at least...
Original storytelling, for sure. There's something exceedingly original about those two films. And I do think the pendulum is swinging back towards that really original stuff. I think audiences are craving originality and to be surprised. And I think just being entertained and making people laugh is really fun and exciting too still.
And not that there's anything wrong with sequels. Pitch Perfect 2 was an excellent film.
So. Thanks.
Which Elizabeth directed, by the way, for those at home. And the Pitch Perfect series, co-starring a Harvard Westlake alum, Ben Platt.
Yes.
Yes. And a pen alum. Oh, wait, no, his family.
No, his
Most
family.
Of his family.
His mom, his whole family, his brother, not, I think all but one. I went to the University of Pennsylvania, and I am a proud Quaker, as are the Platts. But Ben, I think, was actually on his way to Columbia.
That's right.
When we just got him totally off course by casting him as an 18-year-old in Pitch Perfect. We shot it in the summer after his senior year. So he never went to college.
His senior year of high school.
His senior year of high school.
Got
yeah,
it.
He
Harvard
was 18 years old. Yeah.
Got
he
it.
He was cast, then graduated, then came to Baton Rouge, Louisiana to shoot the film.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Wow. And then he was on, I think he was in Book of Mormon originally then on Broadway?
He didn't originate Book of Mormon on Broadway.
Right.
But I think he participated, but he did originate Dear Evan Hansen. He originated Evan Hansen on Broadway.
Which was incredible.
Incredible.
I imagine you saw that.
Yeah.
Well, let's get to you. So where were you born?
I was born in Pittsfield, Massachusetts.
And for those who don't know that part of the world, where is Pittsfield vis-a-vis other large towns?
Vis-a-vis Boston, which is the biggest city in Massachusetts. It's on the opposite end of the state, so it's closer to Albany, New York. Mm. It's in the Berkshires, which is pretty rural, actually. I grew up literally going cow tipping in fields. It was a real Americana, you know, four full seasons. You had to know how to do a lot of things. You had to be able to row a boat and canoe in the summer and swim in the lakes and hike and bike and all of those things. And in the winter, we skied and we ice skated and I played hockey as a kid and, you know, all those sorts of very fun things that I think make you a well-rounded person.
And what about your parents? What did they do?
My father worked in a factory for 33 plus years before he retired from General Electric. Pittsfield is a factory town, so GE was sort of the center of our universe for a very long time throughout the whole baby boom era and into the 80s. We did a lot of defense in the 80s, so building of tanks and weapons systems. We were actually in the 80s, I remember doing drills during the end of the Cold War because we were on the Russians' target list to drop a nuke because we did munitions and things like that in Pittsfield.
Wow.
All of that shut down at a certain point. A lot of the town was pink-slipped. It's one of those, you know, sort of, it's still 20 years later, and I still feel like, you know, it's just now sort of getting back on its feet, Pittsfield. It's become much more of a cultural center than ever before. It's when I learned to love the arts in Pittsfield and going to Boston, going to New York City as a kid. My mom worked in a bank when I was growing up, and she worked sort of at school, and I had two working parents, but we were very working class. Mm-hmm. That's sort of the general vibe of Pittsfield, Massachusetts, yeah. Very working class.
Did you have siblings?
I'm the oldest of four.
Wow.
Three girls and a baby brother.
Wow.
Yeah.
How do you think,
big family.
My wife is the oldest of three girls, there's no fourth, but how do you feel like being the oldest of four siblings informs
shaped
who you
me.
Are.
Yeah. I have some pretty typical firstborn tendencies, you know. I'm real bossy. Very type A. Definitely felt like I was responsible for the younger kids at a very young age. I was given in fifth grade, my brother was born, I'm 12, nearly 12 years older than him. When he was born, I actually had to leave school for quite a long time to help babysit. My mom was quite sick carrying him to term, and afterwards, you know, we just had so much going on. I truly can't imagine having four kids like my parents. I mean, I guess I can, but like, it was wild to grow up that way. And I never had a babysitter that wasn't related to me. So it was a real village effort, you know. I lived in the same street growing up as my grandparents,
wow.
As aunts and uncles. Everybody stayed with somebody in and out of different duplexes where we all grew up. We were a very large family, and we all kind of like hung together. My cousins were my best friends. Really tight family network growing up.
You said that there was an arts scene, at least in Pittsfield, or that helped spur an interest.
Yeah.
What was your original interest in performing and acting?
Well, I literally fell into it. So I played sports growing up. You know, I played basketball. I went to basketball camp. I played softball, was sort of the one I felt the best at. I was on a traveling all-star team. And I was a latchkey kid. As I said, both my parents worked. There's, you know, four of us with a lot going on. I broke my leg sliding into third base, and I needed something else to do after school. And I'd always sung in the choir, and I'd sang at church. And the choir teacher said, hey, I'm going to do Jesus Christ Superstar as like the musical, and you could sing Not Mary Magdalene, which is the role that you want if you're a young woman. You can sing Pontius Pilate because you can wear a long robe over your what was then a walking cast. I was in a cast for like 8 months. I had a spiral fracture of both my tibia and fibula, and basically it was like a hot mess in my leg. I had a couple of different closed reduction surgery, as they're called, where they re-break it and reset it and all kinds of crazy things. So I had a crazy medical situation happen to me when I was in middle school. And so going into high school, it was like, what am I going to do? And I did this Jesus Christ Superstar, and I really kind of liked it. And then I started out in freshman year, just like, all right, let me go to the drama department and see if there's a play I can be in. And by senior year, I was really into it, but never as a career. It was always just my extracurricular activity. I went to Penn thinking that I would be a lawyer, or that I would be a broadcast journalist or something. I wanted to be Diane Sawyer at one point. And, you know, I never really considered what I do for a living now as something that was even possible for someone like me. Every actor I'd ever met was actually just a waiter who did it as sort of a lark, you know, with a hope and a prayer. I don't know. But as I was graduating from Penn, a lot of my friends who were in the theater program with me were applying to graduate programs, to MFA programs at Yale or the Yale School of Drama or at Juilliard. And I applied to NYU, and I applied to Yale, and I applied to ACT in San Francisco. I auditioned on my birthday in New York City. It was the most glorious day. I stayed in New York overnight with my sorority sister in her cute little apartment. She was already up and working in New York as a, you know, graduated the year ahead of me. And I thought, all right, well, maybe I'll just move to New York and figure this out, because it was so glorious. And then I had the best audition. And I ended up getting an ACT, and I went to ACT for grad school, moved to San Francisco when San Francisco was like the place to live because the internet was happening, right? Everyone was moving to Silicon Valley, and San Francisco couldn't have been hotter. There was nowhere to live, actually. It was part of my problem when I moved there. It was such an exciting place to be. And so I did that for a couple of years, and then I went back to New York. And then I worked pretty immediately in commercials. Mm-hmm. I have a very, like, there is no typical path to becoming an actor. I always tell people everybody has a different way of doing it. But certainly going to graduate school, getting an MFA, I know a lot of people do take that path. And I did my showcase and I got an agent and I got sent out on auditions right away. I booked a ton of commercial work and I went and worked at the Guthrie Theater and did some very off Broadway, but basically started working in television really quickly and was bi-coastal for a while, moved to LA, started being an actor. That's it, yeah.
Before getting into your career, whether it was at Pittsfield, you were public high school in Pittsfield?
Pittsfield High School, Pittsfield go high Generals. School.
So whether it was Pittsfield High School at Penn or at ACT, were there teachers, whether they were acting teachers or other teachers that were particularly influential to you and to who you are now and you think back to about their influence in your life?
For sure, always. You know, a couple amazing people. Interestingly, because I know you have a Latin program here, I studied Latin for 6 years. That was because I had an incredible teacher named Janet Rigette. And she had just an incredible love of the classics generally. Through that, there's the Junior Classical League, and I'm pretty sure Harvey Westlake also participates in this, which is basically a series of competitions where there's like oration and, you know, all the old school stuff. You like, part of it is doing performing in Latin, great, you know, orators, poems by Ovid, for instance, you would do. And I did all that coming up. And then there was also in the same program, like people would like build old school Roman catapults, right? Mm-hmm. So it was a whole team that would just build a catapult and we would bring it to Boston Latin in Boston and we'd be in the JCL, the Junior Classical League. So there was this performative element to what I was doing, studying this classical language. But more importantly, so much of what you read in the classics are these great, you read the Aeneid, which is, you know, the Odyssey, the Aeneid. You study both the Greeks and the Latin storytellers. So you read all these Greek plays, you know, and Metamorphosis and all of these incredible things. And as a storyteller, what I have come to realize over time and through studying the classics, they're all sort of the same story, right? These are the stories that came before the Bible and that are also about just human nature. And, you know, they're asked the big questions, why are we here and what are our relationships? And, you know, you think about mothers and sons and fathers and daughters, you know, just the whole thing, all the politics of it. All of that I was working on in like seventh grade. You know, I started studying that in seventh, eighth, ninth, 10th grade. And it created this basis to then study Shakespeare and all the way through to like Bertolt Brecht, you know, like what are all of the classics in theater as well. And so, and I did that in high school with my high school drama teacher, Ralph Hammond, who I literally just saw like 3 weeks ago.
Is that right?
Because he's friends with my dad, and my dad's 75th birthday party was a few weeks ago, and Mr. Hammond was there. And it's funny because I now call him Ralph as an adult woman, but my sister was there too, and she also took classes with Mr. Hammond, and she still calls him Mr. Hammond, and we were all laughing because we can't believe we still call him Mr. Hammond. But he was someone, you know, he took storytelling via plays as, he took it so seriously. He really imbued in me the sense of storytelling as like this long and very old tradition that goes back 10,000 years to when we were sitting around as cavemen around the fire. And instead of just telling a story about, hey, you got to watch out for the lion, it might eat us. Mm-hmm. We were telling stories about the stars and about the moon and about, you know, what the lion really represented to us. You know, we started with metaphor and simile and how important it was for us to be not just communicating life-saving tips like watch out for the lion so it doesn't eat you, go up on the ridge, get in the tree, no, the lion can climb a tree, you know, information. But it really was that our imaginations came alive. And you told stories because it helped children understand the world around them. It helped provided wisdom, right? This tradition still happens today. We want the wise among us to give us truths, you know? I just love that that's what I went into college with, was this sense of, this is actually a really important job. It's not frivolous at all. It really matters to people. If you become a storyteller, if you create content, you are actually joining this incredible legacy of storytellers that came before you that have always explained the world to each other. I love that. So that's what I learned from Ralph and Mrs. Richette.
That's great. And those were both in high school.
Those are both high school teachers. Yeah.
Yeah. And so when you're at Penn and you're kind of going in thinking, oh, I'm going to be a lawyer or whatever, and you're thinking, oh, I really like this acting.
Yeah.
Maybe part of it was thinking, not only do I like this, but this is actually could be important.
Yeah, I felt that, but I also am very practical. And so I want to make money.
Yeah.
I tend to be someone who I don't shy away from speaking about money. I think so many people do. I think it's such a taboo in our society. But I grew up watching my parents struggle to pay bills, and I didn't want that for myself. I know, and my parents didn't want that for me. They wanted it to be easier for me too. So when I decided to pursue acting as a graduate student, mind you, I had tons of student loans at that point.
Right.
I was looking at like, oh my God, am I really going to go 2 more years generating more loans? And like, this is something that kids are dealing with this right now. I remember my uncle, my godfather, who I'm still very, very close with, saying to me, listen, you've gone to Penn now, you've graduated, you know, with honors, you are employable. This was something I didn't really know. You know, you're still figuring out how the world works. He said, you're employable. There's going to be a job for you somewhere. You don't have to worry. You will make money. Because at that point, I was like, I can't go to graduate school, even though I had gotten in. He said, if you don't do it right now, you'll probably never do it. You can do it when you're young. You can take these kinds of risks right now. You have no responsibilities other than to yourself. Go for it. And in 2 years, if it's not working out, you can get a job. He was not wrong. You know, I still say auditioning. I was interviewing for mm-hmm. other jobs at the time that were not me going to graduate school. It was like, I remember turning down interviews at, you know, McKinsey and Company and big banks. I mean, you know, whatever, whoever recruits out of Penn, corporate jobs, corporate America was knocking and offering, you know, salaries that I was like, oh, wow, that'll go a long way to paying off loans. And instead I went to drama school and took on more debt in the hopes that being an artist was going to somehow help me pay those debts off. So when I did pay those debts off, and pretty quickly, I might add, mostly through a commercial for Crest White Strips that aired nonstop during the day when women were watching daytime talk shows and soap operas, you know, I really celebrated. It was a huge weight off of my shoulders to pay those loans off. But yeah, it was my uncle who said, just try, don't worry, take it on. You'll be employable later on.
Did that sense of practicality, I'm curious, because you started a production company, you and your husband, and I want to get to that story as well. Mm. You started the production company very early in your career. I was looking back and, you know, you were in Wet Hot American Summer in 2001. And the production company was started soon.
Well,
after.
We didn't start till 2008.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. I had to create Brownstone in order to be an actress. Everybody has what's like a little company, because we get income from 10 million places. So it's good to have one place where it all ends up.
Got it.
But so Brownstone Productions, which is our production company, sort of evolved into something that my husband and I did together starting around 2008. Hmm. We did that, again, partially practically. He went to Andrew. He also went to Penn, my husband. And he.
You met on the first day?
We met on the first day of school, yes. Also something that I credit with my success is having a great partner who, you know, it's just something you don't have to worry about. I didn't date. So my love life was settled pretty early on. And I had a great partner who was very supportive of everything I was trying to do. He had gone to UCLA's Anderson School of Business. He has an MBA. And he was also looking at corporate jobs. And I, at the time, was traveling all over the world making movies and traveling all the time, never being here in LA. And I thought, oh my gosh, if you go take a job in like distribution at Disney, where you get 2 weeks vacation and, you know, you work 70 hours a week was probably what it was going to be, really. Realistically, you know, some crazy amount of hours. I was like, we'll never see each other. And we were really trying to create a life together. We were married. We wanted to have kids. We wanted to have a family. And we wanted to be together. And he was a writer in college and an award-winning writer in college.
Sports
and,
writer, is that right? Or no?
No.
Oh.
That's such a fun misnomer that we still laugh about. He did write about sports. He loves sports. He wrote a book about fantasy football. In the very beginning of fantasy football, he worked for Fox Digital Ventures back in the day against the beginning of the internet and helped sort of spur on or encourage the development of the fantasy football movement online. Wow. He knew a lot about that in the very early days of fantasy and what it was for gambling, frankly, and what it meant to sort of like, you know, have these teams with your friends, what that was. I wrote a book about that with a friend. And so that follows him to this day on his Wikipedia page, if you Google him. I told him he had to do something creative. He wrote this book. So he was sort of freelancing, if you will, in that time period. And we were looking at a lot of things, books and different things. And he was a real bloodhound for material, is what I'm getting back to. So as a writer, he did a lot of investigative things, journalistic things in college, real bloodhound for material, an avid reader, an avid consumer of culture. And I just thought, you'd be a really good producer. I, at that point, had met a lot of producers. And I was like, you could definitely do this job. We could do this together. And we have a complementary skill set. We work really well together. We really enjoy each other. We still do. That's how we founded the company. And one of the first things that he found was a graphic novel by this guy, Robin Diddy. It was from a small imprint. You know, we didn't go to DC or Marvel. We went to this small imprint out of Atlanta, Georgia, which of course has now been bought by a bigger imprint. And this graphic novel called Surrogates that we turned into a $90 million Disney movie starring Bruce Willis, which we got through the system partially because we were friends with one of the producers, Todd Lieberman, who had a company with David Hoberman, who was a, you know, older, more experienced producer. So basically us Penn grads were just like, hey, can we come along for the ride on this big movie? And that was the very first thing that we ever sent out. And it got made into a film. And, you know, we had a couple other things in development. And then Max, through his connections, writing his book, went to dinner with a book agent that he knew who had just read Mickey Rapkin's Pitch Perfect book proposal and said, I just read this thing. I don't think it's going to sell a lot of books, but I think it could be a really great movie idea. And this is really a fun IP. And having gone to Penn, we were like, we totally know this world.
Because of the acapella?
Yeah, because of the acapella scene at Penn, which I kind of worshipped. I thought those guys, I just love the idea that everybody could be a rock star in college for 5 minutes.
Right. Well, and we connected over this at one point. Your husband's from Portland and my wife is from Portland. So we both have in-laws in Portland. When you say your husband, you have complementary skill sets and you're a partnership in this production company. What are those? Like, what are the things you admire in him, and what would be the things he says he would admire in you other than the opposite?
I think the things that work for us are, he's very diplomatic and he's really business minded, you know, and he really comes, that really is his background. He worked in corporate America, worked in banking, worked for Fox, got his MBA. I think he just speaks a language that is, you know, it's not as familiar to me. It's more familiar to me now, having run a business for 20 years. But whereas I come from things in a much more passionate, much more artistically minded way. And we both are always thinking about the audience for things and who would we be making something for. I think that's a really interesting question. Like, how do we get it done? All of that. But at the end of the day, just he's just much more diplomatic than I am and much more patient than I am. I am very decisive. I think, you know, as a leader, that's something I'm very proud of. And, you know, I know how to make film and television. I've been on 100 sets at this point in my life. You know, I've been able to learn from watching incredible masters at work. I mean, some of my early work, I worked with Steven Spielberg very early in my career. Sam Raimi was a huge mentor. Gary Ross, like, there's just some really fascinating people that I got to work with really early on and, you know, learn from. And it's just been an incredible education to be on the job as much as I have been for as long as I have been. And then to have my husband's skill set sort of on the other side of it, really talking about financing, frankly. How do you know?
Which is also important.
Really can't make any of the things I'm really passionate about making unless you have the money to do it. Every artist has a patron.
Well, let's go to those mentors. You mentioned some of the early directors that you worked with, where it was Gary Ross, probably Seabiscuit, I assume, was that one, and Steven Spielberg, and you worked with Judd Apatow and a number of people.
Yeah.
Who in your mind, when you think back, I guess, to filmmakers, to actors that you've worked with, to producers as well, who are the people, when you think back on your career, and you're right, you have worked really consistently for more than 20 years. You've done amazing television. You did Scrubs and 30 Rock and Modern Family and Cool Roles and all those shows. Who do you think to as the two or three people that you go, wow, that was an education as much as my graduate school or undergraduate?
Well, I don't think that you really know how any of this works unless you're on sets. I remember when I was in graduate school, I went to ACT in San Francisco, which is where like Denzel Washington went there, Annette Bening went there, and Annette Bening came back and spoke to us. So speaking about people who like, you know, came and mentored and whatever, and she came back and spoke to us and she told some really interesting stories about like the difference between doing theater versus doing film and television and her first times on set and learning like, what is it? What is the language? It has this, its own jargon, right? As all industries do. Some of her early work was with De Niro. And at one point he said, he told her, hey, can you just move over and sit down? Like he really taught her. And then she sort of told us about working with the camera versus working with your fellow actor, that like, yes, you want to be present and you want to be there with your fellow actor, but at the same time, you are giving a performance to the camera. The camera is what is capturing what the audience is ultimately going to see. And the composition in that frame is what matters the most. And it's young actors have no idea what that means. And so, you know, she also tells a story about being told, hey, on this next take, can you just sit in? And she was like, I have no idea what that means, sit in. And it literally just means come and sit in before you start talking. So they have like a cut point or an edit. So, you know, learning all of those things really early on, being somebody who just, I just loved learning about that. What is the jargon of my industry? What do all these things mean? Hearing from even a great like Annette Bening that when she first started out, she didn't know what the hell was going on a movie set. I thought like, I'm going to really pay attention. Like, what is going on a movie set? Like, what does it mean when somebody says they're on a long lens? What are all the jobs everyone's doing here? And I remember being on the set of Catch Me If You Can, and Steven Spielberg was so generous with me. Leonardo DiCaprio was so generous with me. I sat in what's called Video Village, which is where the director sits with his producers and sometimes an editor, you know, people that are on set that are sort of watching the monitors, which again is what's in the frame. So a movie set could be, you know, 15 miles wide, but at the end of the day, you're only looking at exactly what's in the frame. There's a lot of things not in the frame or just out of the frame. And watching Steven work and seeing how at ease he was because he had the absolute best in the business running every single department on his film sets. That in and of itself is an education. Like, hire the best people. You don't actually need to know how everything works in every department. You're not going to sew the costumes. Hire the best costume designer. Have great taste. You know, Steven Spielberg has impeccable taste in everything. And when you have a DP that he doesn't have to know exactly how to light every single thing. I mean, of course, he's got an opinion about everything and he knows far more than I'm giving him credit for. He knows everything. He's all knowing. That being said, he is letting people, he's empowering people to do their best work. And as a leader and as a director, I think that should be taken into every corner of all business. If as a leader, your main job is empowering the people who work for you, who report to you, whatever it is in your industry, empower them to do their best work, whatever that means in your industry. Seeing that in action was just really educational. The other thing is that he edits as he goes. That is not true for everybody. A true contrast to that would be Judd Apatow. I think on The 40-Year-Old Virgin, there was some rumor that we shot more film, which that was still on film before digital. We shot more film, so much film, than like any movie that had been seen in a really long time.
And is that because of a lot of the improv?
It's the improv and the takes. So like we would shoot out basically every can of film, right? So like you would just go until it ran out. That's a 10, 15 minute take. And you would do, you know, we would just improv and he had people writing things down and we would come in and we would keep refining it and refining it as we would go. But he wants all of that to look at in the edit and then craft the jokes, especially craft the comedy after the fact in post. Steven, you would start the scene, you maybe a little before, and then you would maybe add a couple things at the end, but he would often come over and say, listen, I'm never going to use that. This scene ends right here. It's going to end on this shot. You just knew he had it in his mind's eye. Like, this is where this moment, this is the penultimate moment in this scene, and then we're going to cut out of it. All this other stuff you're doing, it's never going to be in there. And I find that really interesting. You know, it's a different way to work. Lots of people work different ways, and I learned from both of those experiences, and not every set requires the same toolkit. So two very different ways of working, two great educational experiences.
Yeah. One thing we didn't talk about was the majority of your work, at least early on, was in comedy, or at least maybe not the majority, but a lot of your work has been in comedy.
So funny you say that. Meaning after I did Seabiscuit, which was nominated for a bunch of Oscars, and I did this movie Heights, a Merchant Ivory movie with this incredible cast, I was being compared to Jennifer Connelly. You know, it was like, oh, maybe, or Laura Linney, like people like that. Not funny people. And I came into the business thinking, I'm funny. Like one of my very first movies in New York was Wet-Headed American Summer.
Right.
I saw these people. I felt like I could hang with them. And then I started doing really much more serious work. And so it was not really until The 40-Year-Old Virgin reset my career in a real sense of, oh, she's very comedic. And then the television work that I did was very comedic. And so I got more of a reputation for doing comedy again. I also came to the business, timing is everything in life. I think Malcolm Gladwell has an entire book about this.
Yeah.
You know, I came into the business at the moment that romantic comedy was on the decline. Bromances, partially because of Judd Apatow, were on the rise. And so everything was about the boys all of a sudden. And, you know, female movie stars were really made in our business for so many years in romantic comedy. And there just suddenly weren't as many to do. You know, there were, and really what I also constantly am taking note of is my comedic peers were not doing tons of romantic comedies. So the men in my industry who were considered really funny, like post Hugh Grant and that era, it was like, okay, who's going to take over for Hugh Grant? And it felt like Matthew McConaughey was doing it for 5 minutes. And then he was like, I'm not supposed to. And by the way, I don't disagree. I don't know that he was supposed to be doing it, you know? It was sort of like, wait, why? Where are these really funny guys? Like, why don't they make classic rom-coms, right? Like, why does, you know, I think it's so delightful when you see someone like fall in love and be really fun and funny and charming. Like, charm goes so far in our business. Like, so many of the greats from the 40s and 50s and 60s in our industry were comic actors or had incredible, impeccable comic timing. And we just don't get the chance to sort of see that as much anymore. And so I came into the business thinking I would be doing a lot of rom-com, and then they were not making any rom-coms, and I've basically been in like one rom-com, and it was called Zach and Mary Make a Porno.
Yeah, right. But growing up, or when you were in high school and doing productions or at Penn, was comedy part of why you loved acting as opposed to the sort of high drama, or was it both?
I enjoyed doing both, to be honest. But I have a penchant for comedy. I mean, I'll take an Oscar Wilde play over, I'll take Shakespeare's comedies over his dramas any day. I just love to laugh. I love the entertainment factor, and it's very addicting as when you can make people laugh, it's very addicting. And I find it to be a lot more difficult and more difficult than it gets credit for. I think it's a lot harder to craft a truly, actually funny comedy than it is to create a drama. I'll die on my sword for that.
Yeah.
I just think drama is just easier to make.
Who's the funniest person you've made a movie with?
I've been so lucky to work with some of the just funniest people. I mean, Will Arnett comes to mind right away. He is one of the quickest wits that I've ever been around. The guy never is lacking for a punchline. He can find something funny to say about literally anything. And he's self-deprecating and charming at the same time. So I loved working with Seth Rogen. I felt like just we were comedic. He's so generous with a laugh. Larry David's so generous with a laugh. I think people are intimidated by him because he's so funny and you think, oh my gosh, how will I ever get, I won't be at his level. But you know what? He is there to, he's so supportive and he also wants to laugh. He wants you to be great and be funny. And he's so encouraging. So I loved working with him. And then Tina Fey, you know, at the entire cast of 30 Rock blew my mind. I mean, I went into a room once with Elaine Stritch, Alan Alda, Alec Baldwin, Tina Fey, and me in a room. I mean, I could cry thinking about it. It was like my dream come true. I played Alec Baldwin's love interest. Elaine Stritch played his mother. Alan Alda played his father. And Tina Fey was there. And it was just like, what is this day? You know, like, how did I get here? This is the greatest moment of my life. So, and to just feel like, oh, I can hang with these people. It was felt pretty special.
What do you love about what you do? Like, is there a moment, you know, when you're either directing or editing or performing that you go, wow, maybe it was that moment on the 30 Rock set, but what is it you love most about your career?
I'm going to say something highly controversial in terms of anybody who does the work that I do, which is something that I love is a test audience. 99% of people say I'm crazy. Huh. People do not like testing their movies. They don't like testing their TV shows. You do things for the audience. You need to know if you're taking them on the ride that you intended to take them on. Is it landing with the audience or not? It's a huge question for me. I don't make the art for myself in a closet. I make the art to impact the audience. I want to know, like, what effect am I having on people when they're watching something that I make? So look, it's, you want to throw up the first time you show your baby to anybody. It's harrowing because it could flop and not work, but that's great information to have too. You need to know if it's, you know, I find it really interesting to let the audience help shape the thing. This, trust me, I'm saying something that is highly controversial for a lot of artists. Most of our, you know, and if you're doing a painting or writing a novel, you know what? Do it for you. It's for an audience of one. Make it the thing that you love. And at the end of the day, I typically put things into my art that just delights me as a director, especially, and as a producer. It just delights me. If I'm the only one who's delighted by it, you know, oh well. But I mostly want to know, is it working for the audience? And that's what I aim to do. I aim to impact the audience, whether it's make you laugh or make you scream or make you cry or make you think. You know, I just want to know, does it work for you? That's what matters to me the most.
And so with Cocaine Bear, which you recently directed and was a hit movie, you make it, you edit it.
Yeah.
You think that this line is going to hit. You think that this part is just going to make the audience roll. So showing it to them for that first time, that small group, and going like, is this really...
Yeah.
Having the intended impact that I'm hoping it's going to have. And I imagine sometimes it does, and sometimes the laughs are a surprise as much as they are intended.
Sometimes they're a surprise, but a lot of craft goes into that, Eli.
Sorry. Don't mean to
No, diminish. I just mean to say, like, when you edit, when you're in post, you do show it to, you know, little friends and family, and you and the editor, and, you know, there's a lot of people involved. You get a sense of things pretty quickly. So by the time I'm showing it to the test audience, we're trying out some big moves here and there, but I'm also like, I'm just wanting to get a general sense. Like, is this thing gonna fly or not? So the first time that we showed Cocaine Bear, the centerpiece of the movie is a giant ambulance chase. I was like, if this doesn't work, then the movie doesn't work, because there's such a centerpiece and it's such a high point in the movie. And it's really the whole tone of the movie is in it as well. And we had been trying different songs with it. And, oh, you know, I knew exactly how many surprises I felt were in that sequence for the audience to enjoy. And I knew that it was going to make people like, gasp and laugh and go nuts. And the very first time that we showed it to an audience at Universal, it did just that. We actually filmed people watching that sequence. And it had the intended effect. And I thought, okay, we're on to something. It's going to be okay.
That's great. So to finish up, we have a few get-to-know-you questions. They relate to Los Angeles. We are known for our movies, for our food, and for our climate. So three questions, and then there's one kind of final one as well. What is Elizabeth Banks' favorite movie?
Ooh, I don't have just one, but I will name Pulp Fiction as a just, you know, it's a top fiver. It's going to be on the list forever.
The first time I saw that movie blew my mind.
Yes, like, it's a mind-blowing experience.
The idea that how they switch around the timing and stuff, I saw it at a time where I was pretty young and hadn't seen all the great movies and still haven't, but mind-blowing at the time.
And it announces Quentin Tarantino for, you know, I loved True Romance as well. I would say that's one of my, that's a huge favorite of mine as
Me
well.
Too.
But he didn't direct that movie. So when Pulp Fiction came and Reservoir Dogs, you know, it's like, it just announced an incredible filmmaker with a vision. And I just think it came along at a time when it just elevated everything else around it. You know, in the way that, frankly, like when you went to see Hamilton, you were like, okay, so musicals are never going to be the same, right? I really felt after Pulp Fiction, films are not going to be the same.
What's your favorite meal in LA? It could be something you and Max make at home.
It's sushi. We don't have to get too excited about this. I grew up in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. There's no sushi. I didn't eat sushi until I was an adult. And now that I live in Los Angeles, where, you know, we have some of the best sushi restaurants and sushi generally. Although I am trying to be better about eating fish because I don't want to ruin the oceans. But it's sushi. 100%.
Is there a spot, sushi spot? That's your spot? Are you a sugarfish person?
Asanebo.
Oh, Asanebo.
I mean.
In Studio City, right near the upper school.
Yes, right near the upper school. But there's spot. I live right near that whole row in Studio City of incredible Kazu. And oh, they're all good. Come on. There's so many good spots. Sushi.
What is your favorite place in LA?
My favorite place in LA? Probably it's going to be a hiking trail. It's hiking to the top of, I don't know, one day it'll be Fryman Canyon, another day it'll be Runyon, another day it'll be to the Hollywood sign over in Griffith Park. I just love how the city has so many hiking trails to offer. I love going on walks. I love walking my dog. And I love being high up in the city and really taking it all in. I think it's in it. The vistas here are unbelievable. And to enjoy the weather year-round like we get to do. And I hike even when it's raining.
Last question. You are the parent of two sons.
Yes.
I am the parent of two daughters. Mm. I have a 5-year-old and a 2.5-year-old.
Oh, so you're in it.
The 5-year-old applying to elementary school at the moment. So.
Have fun.
The last question I ask every guest is, what is your best parenting advice?
My best parenting advice is don't give parenting advice until your child is 27, has never gone to jail, is not a substance abuser, is generally a happy, productive member of society. That's my best parenting advice.
So the jury is still out on your...
Who the hell knows?
Well,
I could mess it up.
I doubt it.
I really try not to give too much. I tend not to take too much parenting advice from people whose kids are not 25 and well-adjusted. Other than that, it's like, I'm pretty basic. I will say this. Wait till 8th on the phones. I signed a pledge, wait till 8th.
Cell phones, sorry.
Cell phones. I don't know why any child under 13 needs a cell phone. Stop it, parents, stop it. Every single study coming out is telling us it's bad for their mental health. It's bad for their self-image. It's bad for their motivation. My husband and I were really on the same page about this. We signed a pledge, I don't know when, like in third grade, like we're going to wait till 8th. No, but everyone failed the pledge. That I, you know, all the parents, my poor son, who's just has this incredible life here at Harvard Westlake, still doesn't have a phone, and he's doing just fine. You know, get him a Gab or a watch or something, but like, I don't know. It's just, he's got a laptop. Like, don't make it easier. Keep it a little bit harder for them to get on the internet as long as possible.
Good advice.
That's my advice.
Okay.
I'll just tell you, every parent's like, I can't, my kid. And I'm like, your kid is not in charge. You're in charge. Your whole job is their safety.
And the phones, we're talking a lot about mental health and student wellness at Harvard Westlake. So many things come back to devices, you know, so many.
Try harder, parents. You can do it. I'm telling you, it's a success story. It worked for me. Yeah. My kid still does not have a phone and he's fine. Yeah. It's all right. You can do it. Stay strong.
Elizabeth Banks, thank you so much for joining me for the Sporting Cast in person on campus. Appreciate you being here.
Yeah.
Thank you again.
Thank you.